During the last year or so, I have developed a new series of lessons that I'm using in meetings under the theme, Senseless but Profound. I began this series as I began to think about some of the things that we do in our worship, some of the things that we do as Christians. To a person who doesn't understand God and how God is involved would seem rather senseless, perhaps foolish, a little bit silly. And yet when we understand that we're coming from God's Word and what He has said, that which seems senseless to some is really profound. The text that I'm using as a broad general theme text is from 1 Corinthians 1. At verse 18, "For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness. But unto us which are saved, it is the power of God." Now notice in that verse, the preaching of the cross is to some foolishness, that's senseless. But to other, it's the power of God, that's profound. "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God, it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe." And I want to stop and point out now that didn't say foolish preachers, although sometimes they may be. It said the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Then drop down to verse 26. "For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are." I believe that passage presents the basic idea that we're beginning to present tonight and will bring in 10 lessons over the next several weeks. Senseless but profound. I want to introduce this series with a lesson tonight that I've entitled, "It Made No Sense Then," and look back at some examples in the Old Testament and New of things that are there that made no sense whatsoever at the time to many people who observed it, and yet each one of them was very profound. Let's begin with the ark. In chapter 6 and 7 of Genesis, God told Noah to build an ark. I cannot prove this, but I'm of the opinion that it had never rained at that point. I do know that Genesis 2:6 says at that time that the plants were watered with a mist that went up from the ground. And there may be some reasoning as we look at the creation of the 6 days that the process of rain coming down and evaporation going up would have been a part of that creation. But God had the ability to create everything and then alter its relationship later. He did with man, for example. He created man and then he made woman from the rib that he'd already created. So either way could fit in to his plans. And I think it is a strong possibility that it had not rained at that time. Now, you put yourself in the position of Noah. God says, "Noah, I want you to build an ark." Noah might have said, "An ark? Why?" "I want you to build a ship. I want it to be this long and this wide and this high. I want it to have 3 stories. I wanted to have one window and one door. An ark that would take him literally about a century to build. Build an ark? Why? I'm sure that made no sense to Noah. And I'm rather sure that it made no sense to the other people that were living at that time. I would guess that they ridiculed, made fun of Noah all the time that he was building the ark. Why in the world would you build a boat this big when you don't even need a boat? And if there had been rain, and there was water in that sense, it never rained to the extent that it would indicate a boat of this capacity or this size. That was something that seemed to be, from man's wisdom, something that was senseless and silly and foolish. To the extent that during the time that he was building this ark, he was a preacher of righteousness and did not convert any of his neighbors or any of the people in the community where he lived, except his own family. And I'm not totally convinced, pardon me, something in my throat. I'm not totally convinced that all of his family were faithful to God. I think there is a possibility that Noah's wife and sons and their wives, or at least part of them, were saved because of Noah's faithfulness. This was the way God was going to bring the human race back into existence. That's another thing I cannot prove. But I am convinced, without any doubt, that the idea of building an ark and then taking two animals of every kind and seven of the clean, maybe 14 of the clean, in was something that just made no sense whatsoever to the world in general and possibly didn't make that much sense to Noah. But by faith, Noah prepared that ark. And because of his doing what God told him to do, his family was saved from the flood. Senseless from man's standpoint, but profound from God's standpoint. A little later in the book of Genesis, we have the story of Abraham taking Isaac up and offering him as a sacrifice. God said to Abraham, take Isaac, your son, and go over to Moriah. And I want you to have an altar there, and I want you to put that son on that altar, and I want you to offer him as a sacrifice. Abraham might have said, God, what do you mean? This is the son that's the son of promise. You've already told me that through this son, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed, and now you want me to kill him and offer him as a sacrifice? That didn't make any sense. And if you notice, Abraham didn't even explain to the servants that were with him the details of what he was going to do. In fact, he said, you stay here and the son and I are going yonder and worship. And it's interesting that in that statement he said, and we will return to you. And the indication in Hebrews is that Abraham believed that God had the ability to raise Isaac from the dead if he went ahead and offered him and killed him. But do you think that made any sense to Abraham? And does it make any sense to us today to look back and why in the world would God ask a man to offer his own son as a sacrifice? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Until you put the picture in it with God in it. God was proving to himself and to Abraham that Abraham would do whatever God asked him to do, even to the point of taking the life of his own son, if that's what God commanded. Didn't make sense. But look how profound it was. Go with me over a little further in the Bible to Exodus 12. It's the time of the 10 plagues. 9 of them have already happened. And God explains that he's going to bring what we call the death angel, at least the representative of God that brought about death, through Egypt, and that the death of the firstborn in every household is going to take place. But he said, those of you among the children of Israel, here's what I want you to do. You kill a lamb. He gave them the details of it for a family, or maybe in some instances families going together. And I want you to eat that as a meal, but I want you to take the blood from that lamb and put a little blood on the lintel across the top of the door and put some blood on the doorpost. And when the angel comes through and death takes place, there will be no death in any house that has the blood on the lintel and the doorpost, as long as you stay in the house. And that's another lesson. They had to get where God told them to get and stay where God told them to get in order to be protected. But what is there in the blood of a lamb that will protect anyone from death? And can't you just imagine that at that point, if the Egyptians understood what was happening, that they would have made fun of it? They didn't make fun of it a little later. Because after that night, the firstborn in every house in Egypt that didn't have blood on the lintel and the doorpost was dead. And not a firstborn in the houses that had the blood on the lintel and the doorpost died. Blood on the lintel and the doorpost, what's that got to do with life and death? Not a thing, when you look at it from the wisdom of man. But it's profound when you look at it from the wisdom of God, because that's what God said do. And if they had not put the blood there from the type of lamb that he had said, what do you think would have happened? You know what would have happened. Senseless, but profound. They left Egypt and they came to the Red Sea. They were hemmed in, the Red Sea in front of them, the Egyptians behind them. God said, Moses, take that rod that you've got and hold it out over the Red Sea. What? Hold that rod out over the Red Sea and it will part. Moses took that rod. What is there in a rod that will part water? Not a thing. How much sense does that make that here's somebody that's going to hold a rod out over such a body of water and it's going to stand back and give them dry land for the entire group of the Israelites, perhaps 3 million, 3.5 million, to walk across? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That's not the way you would get 3 million people across a body of water, is it? God said, just take that rod and hold it out over the water, and you'll have dry land to walk across. Senseless. Until you put God in the picture. And then it becomes profound. And here's the one that I really like in these that I'm using tonight, and that's the brazen serpent in Numbers 21, 6 through 9. They had sinned against God, and the serpents were biting them, and they were dying. Moses appealed. God said, all right, you put up a post, and you put a brass serpent upon it. And when anybody's bitten, if they will look on that brass serpent, they will not die. What is there about a piece of brass in the form of a serpent put up on a stick for people to look on? Medically speaking, not a thing. And you and I would think, well, that's senseless to believe that you can put a pole up in the air and put a brass serpent on it. And if anybody's bitten with a snake, they come and look at that brass serpent and they won't die. If they don't look at it, they'll die. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever from a medical standpoint or any other standpoint, except it's what God said do. This last week, I have read a book that's entitled Muscle and a Shovel. It's one of the best books that I have read, and I'm going to get some copies of it. I want you to read it. It's the book, you may have heard of this, in the last year or so, there's a community down in Alabama that put this book in every house. And it created some problems in that it teaches the truth. There are over 1,000 verses in the book. But in the reasoning, particularly with baptism, with these two men, the one that's teaching the other, he uses this brass serpent as an example. And he uses it in a setting where the one who's being taught was trying everything he could to get away from the gospel. And he said, well, my pastor told me that you folks of the Church of Christ are, that you believe in water salvation. You're water dogs. And as I was reading that and knowing that I was going to use this point in this lesson, I thought, well, then these folks back there were snake dogs. They believed you could look on a snake and be saved. That's one of the best parallels, and you might put this in back in your memory to use if you're talking to people when they say we believe that the salvation is in the water. Did they believe the salvation was in that brass snake? No. But they believed that God meant what he said. And if they could look on a snake and be saved from physical death, doesn't it make just as much sense that we can be baptized in water to save us from a spiritual death? Because that's what God said. And by the way, one of our 10 lessons will be on that point entirely. But he put up a brass serpent. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Let your mind go from that to the time of the fall of the walls of Jericho. And I've mentioned this in other lessons even recently, but it fits into what we're talking about tonight. Here's a walled city. Perhaps very, very thick walls. Children of Israel needed to conquer it. God said, all right, here's the way I want you to conquer it. I want you to get the people together and put the priest in front of them. And I want you to march around that city one time a day for 6 days, and then on the seventh day I want you to march 7 times, and when you finish that 7th time around, I want the priest to blow on the ram's horns and I want the people to shout. Now what kind of military strategy is that? Can you imagine ever using anything like that if we were trying to take a city today in a war? And this was a battle with the children of Israel and the people of Jericho. March around the city 13 times, one time each for 6 days, and then 7 times on the 7th day, and then blow a horn and shout? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. That's foolishness from man's standpoint. But you know, when they did it, it worked. And the walls fell, and every indication is they fell outward so that the children of Israel could march into the city. Senseless but profound. Senseless from man's viewpoint, but profound from God's standpoint. Taking that one and the crossing of the Red Sea, let me tell you a little story. A young man went to Bible class, and he'd never been to Bible class before, and he came back home. He was probably 8 or 10 years old, and his mother said, son, what'd you study today? He said, well, we studied about the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea. She said, well, what did they do? Well, he said, they came up to this big body of water, and they called in a bunch of helicopters and bombed that water and got it to stand back, and they called in all of these submarines to be sure that they were in the right place, and they called in so many thousand troops, and they got it all together, and then they called in these bombers, and they bombed it and got rid of that water, and they walked across. She said, are you sure that's what happened? He said, no, but if I told you what the teacher said, you wouldn't believe it. And I suspect that that would have been the case. That rod over the sea, 13 times around the city of Jericho, senseless, but profound because God was in it. Naaman, want your leprosy cleansed? Go dip in the Jordan River 7 times. What? What is there in the Jordan River that'll take care of leprosy? Nothing. No chemical there, no medicine there. But you go dip in the Jordan River 7 times and you'll be cleansed of leprosy. It didn't make any sense to Naaman, because remember, he refused it at first. And then the idea that he had to go to a certain river if he was going to dip sounded senseless to him. He said, well, let me dip one of these rivers here in Damascus. No, Naaman, God's message was through his representative, prophet, you go down there to the Jordan River, you dip 7 times, and your leprosy will be clean. There's not a doctor anywhere that would recommend dipping in the Jordan River 7 times to cleanse leprosy. In fact, I can say to you, there's not a thing, medically speaking, about the Jordan River that will cleanse leprosy. That was senseless. Why do I need to go down to the Jordan River? Why do I need to dip 7 times? What is there? Was that water salvation? Let me throw in as we pass. But when Naaman went down the 6th time, he still had his leprosy. Came up the 6th time, he still had his leprosy. When he dipped the 7th time, the Bible says he was as clean as a child. His leprosy was cured. Senseless. Doesn't make a bit of sense from man's standpoint. Foolish. Dipping the Jordan River 7 times. But when he did what God said do, it was profound. And his leprosy was cleansed. All of these have been in the Old Testament. Let me come to the New Testament and use 2 examples. Matthew 14. There were 5,000 people that needed to be fed. Jesus said, "What kind of food have you got?" "Well, we've got a little boy here that's got five loaves and 2 fish. 5,000 people need feeding. And all the food you've got is 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Jesus said, "Set them down and I'll take this and I'll feed them." What? You're going to take 5 loaves and 2 fishes and feed 5,000 people? That's exactly what God did through Christ on that occasion. When Jesus said, "Do that," there was a doubter in the crowd. What do you think he would have said? "Huh? You think you can do that? Why, that's foolish. You know you can't take 5 loaves and 2 fish and feed 5,000 people." And in the next chapter, we have the 4,000 fed with 7 loaves and a few fishes. And even baskets full taken up after they were through. It doesn't make any sense that you can take 5 loaves and 2 fishes or 7 loaves and a few fishes and feed 4,000 or 5,000 people until you put the power of God in it. And then it becomes something that's profound. There is a situation in Luke 5 that I want to use to close today because the wording is such that it just fits exactly what we're talking about. Peter and the people with him had been fishing all night. They hadn't caught anything. Jesus gives him a commandment in verse 4. When he left speaking, he said unto Simon, "Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a draught." Simon, you let your nets down out there and you're going to have a tremendous number of fish. Simon answering said unto him, "Master, we have toiled all night and taken nothing." We already know that there are no fish out there. It would be senseless for us to take the time to cast our nets out there. We've been trying all night, and we haven't caught anything. But here's the clincher. "Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net." Peter said, "Lord, it doesn't make a bit of sense, but if you say do it, I'll do it." And when they had done this, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes and their net broke. That was one of the most senseless, foolish, silly commands that Jesus could have given from the standpoint of these men who had been fishing all night and knew that there wasn't anything there. But Peter said, "I don't understand it." And I think he was basically saying, "I'm not for sure it'll work. But if you say do it, I'll do it." Now there's the clincher of our lesson and our series. There are several things in the Bible that don't make any sense to me if I try to explain it from man's standpoint. The virgin birth doesn't make any sense. I couldn't find a doctor that would say that that's ever happened from a medical standpoint. I couldn't find a scientist that says it could happen that way. And it doesn't make any sense until you put God in it. There is one chapter in Psalms that I want you to read this week. It's number 73. It's not a psalm of David, it's a psalm of Asaph. In the first 16 verses of that psalm, he explains sort of what we've been talking about tonight. He said, I looked at the wicked and they've got all these things, and then I looked at myself and I don't have anything. I look at them and they're healthy and I'm sick and they've got all these things. And he said, I just don't understand it. My feet are well nigh slipped. He uses slippery places in two places in the first 16 verses. From verse 18 on, he says, now I understand this. I understand that I'm the one who's got what matters and the wicked don't. Verse 17 in that chapter, this is Psalm 73, is the key. He says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then understood I their end. He said, I looked about me in the world and I saw all these things happening and it didn't make any sense. And I was even discouraged by it. I was just about ready to give up. My feet were on slippery places. I was about ready to slide back until I went into the sanctuary of God. Until I looked at it from God's viewpoint. Then, when I looked at it from God's viewpoint, I understood their end and I understood where I am as a follower of His and what I have that matters. There are a lot of things about the world. There are a lot of things that are going on in our country right now that don't make sense. And sometimes it appears that the ones that are the most wicked are the ones that have the most. And the ones that violate God's will are the ones that are getting the notoriety. Until we go into the sanctuary of God and we look at it from His viewpoint, then we will understand that because of God and because of His wisdom, all these things matter and all these things will work. There are a lot of things that are senseless and foolish when we look at it from man's viewpoint, but profound when we look at it from God's standpoint. You take even the extending of the invitation sort of fits into this. We come to the end of a sermon and we say, if you'll hear, believe, repent, confess, and be buried with Him in this baptistry back here or somewhere that you can be buried in water, you'll be forgiven of all your sins. That doesn't make sense from man's standpoint. And if you're already a Christian, all you've got to do is just be penitent and confess it and pray to God, and He'll wipe the slate clean. That's not the way we usually work as humans. That doesn't make any sense until you put God in it and the power of God and the power of the blood of Christ. And then it becomes profound. March around Jericho 13 times, it worked. Dip in the Jordan River 7 times, it worked. Hold your rod out over the Red Sea and it'll part, it worked. Cast your net out there where you haven't caught any fish all night and you'll have a drought, it worked. Didn't make any sense. But it worked when God was in it. And the process of becoming a Christian and the process of receiving forgiveness will work if we'll just trust in God. And if you need to make a move in that direction, come us together. We stand and sing.